All right, we're going to get started. I know we have more people coming in. That's fine. There's lots of seats, especially right up front. Well, welcome, everyone. I am Dawn Fraser Bonnard, and I am the Senior Vice President and Chief Diversity Inclusion Officer for Liberty Mutual Insurance, and based in Boston, which is where our headquarters is. And I have to say, if you're like me, you're probably sitting here going, wow, can I take in more? But we've got more, so I hope that you have room for that. I am processing all the amazing things that I've heard today. I know I have more than three joy lists for my gratitude, thinking about Sheryl Sandberg's sharing tonight when I lay my head down on my pillow. So much rich wisdom and storytelling, and again, that we're not finished, so hang on. We've got some really great, great things to share with you over this next hour. So I am thrilled to be here on behalf of Liberty Mutual and really thrilled to support the advancement of women leaders across the state. Really happy to be a supporter of the Texas Conference for Women. The topic of women's advancement and how we engage men as allies to accelerate gender equity is a critical strategic imperative for most corporations, but especially for mine as I talk about Liberty Mutual. 3 years ago, we launched our Women and Allies Employee Resource Group, and part of that launching was including focus on engaging men in the process. And I'm happy to say, if you remember, Melanie Foley, who's my boss, shared this morning that we are hosting our very first Men as Allies Summit this December. Where we're going to bring together 400 men and 100 women to dialogue and really grapple with the opportunities and challenges around gender diversity and gender collaboration. So this topic is very dear to all of our hearts. So I want to thank you in advance for participating in this session, which is entitled Gender Partnership, Engaging Men as Advocates to Pioneer Gender Equity. I want to now introduce you to our thought leader and speaker for this session, who will be moderating this amazing panel. And so I'd like to introduce you to Jeffrey Tobias Halter, and I'm going to share a little bit, just a little bit, so we can jump right in to the discussion. So Jeffrey is a gender strategist, and he is the president of Why Women, which is a strategic consulting company. And it really focused on engaging men on women's leadership issues. And I got to tell you, there are not enough men out there doing this work. So I very much applaud that he is here. Thank you for being an ally and helping us move this direction. What's also great is not only is he a consultant, but he has worked inside different systems. So he knows what it means to be in an organization and drive strategy to make change. He was the diversity manager for the Coca-Cola Corporation, one of two organizations that he worked for that actually won the Catalyst Award, which is a very significant achievement. He is a prolific writer, so he's got a couple of books there. Many of you may have picked them up today at the bookstore. If you haven't, a little commercial there. And also you may have read some of his articles in the Wall Street Journal, in the Atlantic, in Forbes, and so on and so forth. And if you haven't checked out his TED Talks, I highly recommend that you do so. I've had the honor, actually, the opportunity to partner with Jeffrey when I was on a panelist, was a panelist on a panel. At the Simmons Leadership Conference, which is another women's conference in Boston. And I'm also happy to say that Jeffrey was able to come to one of our Women and Allies Employee Resource Group functions earlier this spring, where he was able to talk about the importance of allyship. So I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to turn it over to Jeffrey. Give him a welcome, please.
Thank you, Dawn.
Jeffrey Tobias Halter.
Thank you. So, how do you cycle Sheryl Sandberg and Viola Davis? Bringing a 60-year-old white guy to talk to a room full of women about creating advocates. So I do understand the optics of this and why this is so important. What's really both promising and challenging are some of the remarks that Dawn made, and that is, believe it or not, there are a lot of men who want to help. We are here. We are ready to be allies. My belief in the companies that I work with are up to 30% of men are ready and willing to help. Sadly, we need to be invited in. I'm not saying that's right. I'm not justifying that behavior, but it's just kind of the way it is. It's status quo, and we have to learn to upset that. And so the way we do that is by engaging men. Because you don't have to convince women this is a good idea. You've got to convince men. Men are 85% of senior leadership in most of our companies, which says we're 85% of the problem, but we're also 85% of the solution. And so my TED Talk that Don mentioned, and this is with all due respect to Sheryl Sandberg, is called It's Time to Stop Asking Women to Lean In, and It's Time to Start Asking Men to Stand Up. Because it's about moving men from just this benign knowledge to advocacy. And that's where we want to go today. And the reason we have an all-female panel to talk about this is we want to share tips and techniques that these women have successfully used in their companies to go back and engage men. Because I would love to tell you that there were 8,000 men clamoring to come to the Texas Women's Conference to hear this message. It's not happening. And so I have to ask you to do one more thing in your already crazy business life, and that's to go back and share this information and invite men into the conversation. So that being said, you applauded me. I want to applaud the few brave men who came out today. If you want to give them a hand. Ladies, remember us when you take over. We were here for you. You are going to take over. Just a matter of time. And this is the last time you should ever applaud men for coming to a women's conference. It should be an expectation of being a leader. And so I want to just set a little context for about 5 minutes around how do you start to go back and have this conversation and what's important. To talk to men, to engage men, it's 80% head and it's 20% heart. Because we have to understand the business case. We have to be able to articulate the business case. Oh, by the way, the business case hasn't changed in 20 years. But we have to learn how to talk about that to drive that engagement. So 80% of it is the business case. 20% of it is a personal connection. So we're going to talk about that just very briefly. Then we're going to go to the panel to really highlight those. So the first thing to do, the four things men need to do to become engaged. Most leaders want to start by leading. In fact, that's actually point number three. The first thing you have to do is listen. And what I ask people to do is to take folks like themselves out to, or unlike themselves out to coffee. And just ask a simple question. Miriam, tell me about your experience as a woman in the workplace. And oh, by the way, Miriam doesn't want to be the flag bearer for all things women in the organization. And so as a man, I need to understand that I'm not going to get great feedback right away. And then I have to ask again, tell me what I don't know. And you might go a little bit farther. And then I have to just listen. Don't interrupt. Don't say, oh, that's the program, that's the policy, blah, 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 blah. Just listen. And then ask one more time, what don't I understand? And in that last 10 minutes, I'm going to hear root cause issues that I did not know existed in my company. And so by you being the collective voice of women in your organization, that's how we're going to start to drive engagement. Then we can start to learn. Learning is beginning to articulate the business case. The business case is overwhelming. You heard some of these statistics from the main stage. Women are $7 trillion to this economy. Women buy or influence 83% of literally everything sold in America, including men's underwear. Women buy more men's underwear than men do. Think about that one for a minute. Some of our panelists, at-home banking and financial services. Women influence over 80% of bill paying in this country. We're going to talk about health care. Women influence 96% of health care decisions in this country for themselves and their families and for their parents. And so how can we even begin to talk about healthcare without starting with women? Unfortunately, we don't do that. So the revenue piece is important. If you're in a B2B, if you're not selling directly to women, there's some great research from Harvard Business Review that says your customer base is changing. I do a lot of work with Department of Defense. There are more women than ever. Up to 40% of women are sitting on the buying desk, buying your goods and services from a B2B standpoint. What does your customer team look like? And do you have a bunch of men showing up selling to women? This is a recipe for disaster. So you've got to figure out kind of the revenue piece. And then there's the talent piece. How do we talk about talent in our organization? If you remember nothing else, remember this. 10,000 boomers a day are leaving the workforce. Most are older white men like myself. We started about 7 years ago, and within 7 years, we're all going to be gone. 10,000 a day, every week, for the next 7 years. Think about what senior leadership looks like. And then think about what the organization looks like today. 85% of new entries into the workforce are women, multicultural associates, or millennials. And so this room looks much more like the face of leadership in 10 years than it does today. So there is a war for talent. So that's how you have to learn. And then you can lead. Then you can choose to be a vocal, visible advocate, because now you have context in how to do that. Showing up is a big piece of this. It's funny, Viola Davis said that. Many times men just have to show up and listen and demonstrate their support. We've got male leaders like that for the companies that our sponsors represent. So that's the head piece. That's the 80% head piece. And that's how we get over some of our biases and some of our issues. The 20% piece I have found is a personal connection. And what that personal connection is many men never make the realization that if I'm not advocating for women, I'm actually betraying my daughter's future. And it's not intentional. I can say this firsthand. I represent a lot of boomer men who wanted to raise really strong daughters and encourage them, whether it was sports or music, made sure they went to a great college. And then when my daughter graduates and makes 78 cents to my son, when my daughter graduates and is faced with the same biases that I know exists in my company, I choose to do nothing. This is about choice. And so fathers of daughters, fathers of working spouses, fathers who were raised by single women need to be outraged that society and our organizations value women less than men. And I know that sounds really heavy-handed, and I don't care. I'm telling you, it works. So it's this combination of listen, learn, lead, and then having the will that comes from this personal connection that's going to help you go back and have more meaningful conversations with men. This 30% of men who are ready to help. And then it's like brand adoption. If we can get 30%, then we can get 50%. And then we're at 70, and that's a good number, because I'm going to tell you, you are not going to change the minds of 30% of the men in your organizations. There are men who are never going to see this as a good idea. And our hope is they will, you know, if you create a culture, if you create an organization where women thrive, well, you know, something tells me they're just going to kind of work their way out the door. So that's what the research shows, and that's how you go back and start to engage men in this really meaningful dialogue. And again, I apologize that you all have to go do that, that there aren't, you know, 8,000 men at this conference. But that's data, that's research. What I want to do now is turn to our panelists who are living this every day and share with you tips and techniques around how you can go do this back in your companies. So their bios are in your program. And I want to save a lot of time for Q&A, but I want to welcome Miriam and Mary and Janet. So please give them a hand. And so, Miriam, we're going to start with you. And we had a pre-call, and you said that you've had a long career in your company. You've worked with a lot of women, but now you're working for this guy who just gets it. And I think it reinforces this point about listening and you being able to have an honest conversation. with him. Share that story with the group around how that came to be, what some of those learnings have been, because I think it's a really nice build on this.
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Marianne Cavanigas. I am the plan president for the Texas Health Plan, the South Texas Health Plan here in the state of Texas for United Healthcare Community Plan. And in my role, I've been with this company for about 13 years, so you're right, I've been here for a while. United Healthcare is a Fortune 6 company. And just like many other Fortune 500 companies, we have a lot of women that work for our organization. In fact, we've got over 250,000 employees at United, and 70% of those are women. So you would, if you look at those numbers, you could look at that and go, hey, United's doing really well. But when you look at our boardroom, if you look at our executive levels, it actually falls to less than half of that. So it's actually somewhere around 30%. And so the reason that I shared the story with Jeffrey about my experience is because in my 13 years at United, for the first 7, I worked mostly for women, which was great, wonderful experiences. But as I, about the last 6 years or so, I've had a new leader who is a gentleman. And, you know, I will be honest, it took time for us to develop a relationship and for me to be able to prove my skill set. But once we got past that, we were actually able to have a very honest conversation because he has a set of skills that I don't have, and I have a set of skills that he doesn't. And so there was a natural partnership. In fact, there's people in this room that know us well, and they tend to call us Batman and Robin. So there's a nice partnership between the two of us, and that's developed over time. But along the way, we've had very frequently honest conversations about gender issues. And I was very frank with him that I felt like I was kind of stuck in my role that I was in. And he actually developed an action plan for me. We sat down together and talked about what would it take to get you to that executive level and what can I do to help you get there. And so that action plan included a series of things, more exposure to executive folks, executive development programs, helping me fill some of the gaps of the skills that I am missing, right, that he had where we kind of worked together there. And what's interesting is that if you look at what's happened over the course of that time, his career has taken off as well as mine, and I now am sitting in one of those executive roles. And so I don't know, honestly, that I could have gotten there on my own without that partnership and without having that ally. So I think having that honest conversation made a huge difference, and being vulnerable.
What led you to that point to be able to have that first conversation? Because that's often a lot of the questions we get is, what was that tipping point?
Sure.
How did that first conversation take
Absolutely.
Place?
So, you know, where it actually all started is that what he said to me one day, he goes, I can see you running this health plan. And honestly, if I'm being really frank, I couldn't see that for myself because I couldn't see a path to get there. And so when he said that, I think he probably saw the reaction that I had, which was, you know, one of like, really? And he's like, what's that reaction, right? And that's what led to that conversation. So I think being honest and vulnerable about what I felt my potential was and him being honest and open with me about what he saw in me and what I needed to still do to get there. Yeah. Because it wasn't that he was saying, you're awesome, you rock. He was like, no, you've got some holes you've got to fill here. You know, I mean, so, and we're going to work on that together.
That's awesome.
So, yep, I'm very grateful to him for that.
All right. Mary, you've been with USAA now for a while, and you've taken some big steps around creating gender partnerships mm-hmm. internally. Mm-hmm. Can you share some of those with the company, with the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. And that's a great example of a powerful gender partnership right there. So at USAA, we focus a lot on two components of everybody's performance. There's the how and there's the what. The what is what you do in terms of business results and your contribution to the overall goals, but the how is how you do it and how you achieve those goals. And part of the how, we focus on creating conditions for people to be successful, for people to succeed, as well as including diverse perspectives. And that lays a framework for everybody to be successful. But then very specifically, we begin to focus our efforts on areas where we feel like we have opportunities to improve and areas that we want to focus on from an issue perspective. So we have diversity business groups that we align to various issues across our organization. organization. One that's focused on gender partnership is called Elevate. And Elevate specifically focuses on creating stronger gender partnerships. And it's not just a females group or a woman's group. It's a gender partnership group. It's about making sure that all voices are heard and creating a stronger organization and a stronger team because we are including all voices. And so we have had really great success in a lot of the efforts that we have been leveraging within Elevate. And we've really been focusing on practical work to help progress those voices and help progress male and female partnerships across the enterprise. So, for example, speed networking or speed mentoring sessions with executives. And those executives that participate in those mentoring sessions are both male and female. We've had career builder workshops, again, both male and female that participate in those. We bring in external speakers and we bring in internal leadership panels, again, male and female, so that we can get diverse perspectives as a part of that. And there's a double benefit. Not only do we get to hear from multiple perspectives, but then engaging men to be a part of the Elevate organization with us begins to create advocacy, both at the executive level, so a top down, but then also the participation in those events creates advocacy and engagement from the bottom up as well. Our biggest area of opportunity is continuing to ensure that people understand that it's not a woman's group. It's really open to everyone, and the intent is better gender partnerships, which that benefits both men and women across the board as we're stronger together.
And what's so powerful about that, and for the folks in the room, you know, what one thing can you do? This notion of inviting men in, mm-hmm. bringing them to an event like this. Because believe it or not, for many men, this is the first time they will have been in the minority in their entire lives. And believe it or not, you know, immersion is a great way to kind of demystify this and say, wow, this is really powerful.
Yeah.
So, Janet, you run an amazing company based on brain-based research around power and unconscious bias. And you get to work with a whole host of different companies. What are you finding that's working, and what are you finding that's not working?
Wow, that's a huge question. You know what?
Other than that amazing necklace.
Yes. There we go, that's better. So I'll speak to unconscious bias specifically, because how many of you have had some kind of training in unconscious bias? Yeah, how many did that training happen within the last 2 years? Yeah. I've been working with unconscious bias and unconscious bias researchers for well over a decade. So this information is not new, but it's been revolutionary in terms of redefining the way we think about diversity and bias. But the problem is that unconscious bias training, if it's done poorly, and a lot of it is done poorly, can do more damage than good. Because there's this idea that you can plunk somebody into a class for, you know, it started out, people would say, can you do a day long? And then they said, could you do a 4 hour? Well, our people don't have very much time. Can you do 3 hours, 2 hours, 90 minutes, an hour? And when you compress understanding bias into such a short period of time, and it's a one-time event, it doesn't do anything at all to change behavior. And in fact, it can normalize bias, because it can take somebody who would have been embarrassed by their biased behavior before if they caught it, and then make them feel like, well, it's just the way the brain works, and, you know, everybody does it, so I guess I shouldn't feel so terrible about it. So I think with this kind of training, what is really important is to do pre-work and aftercare. And make sure that the training itself is long enough and deep enough that people get an immersion into not only the science of how bias works. And by the way, unconscious bias is not the only neural process at play when we're talking about diversity. There's a whole host of other factors as well, including the biology of belonging and power and stereotype threat. Huge topic. But that the training go deep enough on the science, go deep enough on the research. But most importantly, there has to be a how to do something about it. And that's the part that oftentimes gets left out. And when you learn about bias, And then you leave and you don't know what to do about it. And you realize, I've been doing this all my life, but I'm not really sure what to do differently. It's a pretty disempowering place to be left. So I think, and I'll probably speak more to this later, but you have to do some pre-work to really understand, and this goes along with your model, Jeffrey, about learn. You have to really understand what are the issues that are happening in an organization. What do you need to address with this training? And then after you do a program, you have to have some aftercare to help instill these patterns of behavior, both individually and culturally, into the company. And most of the kinds of training that we're seeing right now doesn't do that. It just truncates it into this very quick dip your toe in it. Now you know about bias. Go be different.
So that's great. Thank you. So those are kind of the listen components. We're going to focus on shifting this into the business conversation. And Marion, we talked earlier that 94% of healthcare decisions are driven by women. That's a great soundbite, but what is your company doing to really get people to think about this every day and so that it's actually driving business decisions as opposed to just being a soundbite?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's interesting that you say that. The line of business that I work in at United is the Medicaid business, and 80% of Medicaid recipients are women and children, okay? So we, in our line of business, have been dealing with, you know, focusing on women for a long time because we recognize that they're the ones who are really not just covered but making decisions for their kids. But when you step outside of the Medicaid space and you look at healthcare in general, he's right. 94% of those decisions are impacted by women, be it for their parents, their children, their spouses, their family in general. And so the reality is that as an organization, for a long time, we used to make decisions based on what we thought was the right thing for our members, right? And so what are the right things to cover for members? And what are those great features that would make someone want to join our health plan? And I think, you know, there's been a real shift within our organization over time to really start to look at things from the perspective of the consumer. And so if the decision maker is a woman, then that's who needs to be at the table, right? And so the reality is that within our organization, that might mean that the women need to be at the board table so that they're the ones who are actually influencing the decisions for other women. And one of the things that just drives me crazy, I remember seeing not that long ago about some health legislation that was going through. And this is not at United, but at the federal level. And all of the people sitting around the table making those decisions were all men. Every single one. There wasn't one woman at that table. And that broke my heart because what I realized in that moment is, you know, our voices are not necessarily being heard. And so what is United doing about that? A lot. Actually, we've had a diversity and inclusion committee for a long time. But what's really interesting that's happened recently is that we have a new CEO of United Healthcare who, this is like his pet project. And so all of a sudden now everyone wants to be involved in the diversity and inclusion committee. Isn't that funny how that works? Before you couldn't get a whole lot of people that would raise their hand, and now everyone wants to raise their hand. So that's a really good thing. But there's a lot of other things that we're doing just to make sure that women are represented equally within our organization. So working around focusing on mentorship, and not just mentorship for women, but also mentorship for men, and putting pairs together, right, to make those great partnerships. In addition to that, focusing on education for leaders and managers within our organization. And then I think that the last thing that I would say is that, you know, I think over time, as an organization, what we've started to realize is that those shifts in leadership at the top really have to happen. So if you look back at our organization 10 years ago, you would have seen that our office of the CEO was comprised of basically four guys like you, four white guys.
Pretty much.
Now if you look at that, it's comprised actually 50-50 of men and women. And so that's actually a really great thing to see evolve.
Yeah. So, along a similar vein, Mary, you and I were talking about financial services. And I don't want to steal your thunder, but there's some amazing sound bites around how you're connecting women and wealth mm-hmm. and why this is so important. So would you share those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in the financial advice or investment field for the entire 20 years of my career, and it has historically been a very underrepresented field from a female perspective, very male-dominated. And that hasn't changed a lot over the last 20 years, certainly not over the last decade. It's improving slightly, but we've got opportunity in the industry across the board. And I think where people miss the boat is understanding the impact from a business aspect. You talked about 80% with the head and 20% with the heart. Understanding the business aspect and the business benefits of having a diverse workforce, especially in the field that specifically I'm in, advice and investments and financial planning. So some of the stats that Jeff was alluding to earlier, research will show that 34% of households In 34% of households, women are the primary financial decision maker. And yet, broader than that, in most households, 70 to 80% of household financial decisions are either controlled or influenced by the woman in the household. And then you look at the transfer of wealth that's coming. So you talked a little bit about the baby boomers aging into retirement and exiting the workforce. Well, the other aspect of that comes with the fact that men tend to not live as long as their wives. So wives tend to outlive husbands. And so as we are entering into retirement, there is also a huge wealth transfer that's beginning to occur right now. And with the wives outliving the husbands, a lot of that wealth transfer will happen between a husband to a wife. And so by 2020, it's projected that women will control over $22 trillion, with a T, trillion, in assets. So it is important that we have a diverse set of advisors, financial advisors and financial services representatives that are advising women and speaking to them in their terms and in ways that are meaningful and relevant to them. Because there are differences in the way that men and women think about their finances. So one simple example, when you ask women what their top priority is in retirement, number one, women will say across the board, not being a burden on their loved ones. Men will say, maintaining my lifestyle in retirement. Now, that doesn't mean that they both don't worry about those. Because as you look down the list, you'll see as men don't want to be a burden to their family and women want to maintain a lifestyle. But their number one priorities are different. And what that tells us is the way we talk to the different genders and the areas that we choose to focus on and even the solutions and the products that we develop to meet their needs probably look a little different. And so it's critically important that we mirror the people that we serve. So specifically within USAA, we have a focus on the military community, which is a very diverse community. And so it's important that our employee base mirror what our community looks like so that we can be relevant and meaningful to them. So we have a lot of grassroots efforts, very similar to yours. I talked about some of them earlier, but also making sure that we are hiring diverse candidates. We have diverse pools of candidates when we're hiring for different roles, diverse interview slates. So we have interviewers that are diverse as well. So we get different perspectives on those that we're hiring. But it takes a conscious effort to shift that.
Yep. And what's the number on the number of women who fire a financial planner when their husband dies?
Yes, 70% of women leave their financial advisor upon the passing of their husband. 70%.
And why is that?
Because they feel like it's their husband's advisor. They were not talked to in meetings. They were not engaged with in meetings. I have seen it firsthand.
Isn't that amazing? That's just mind-boggling to me.
70%.
So, no, it's not. Yeah, no, of course, the women aren't surprised. Yeah. Right? So, and by the way, men, when you go to see your financial planner, the actuary charts, we just disappear sometime, you know, between 78 and 83, and the women chart goes, like, forever.
Yeah.
So if you haven't been, I recommend you go. Jana, we've been talking about the business case, and you do some just amazing work on everything from dynamics of power to unconscious bias. How are you connecting what some people might say are these soft skills back to productivity, engagement? What are you seeing your company saying back to you?
Yeah. Well, before I go there, I want to comment for a moment on this financial advising thing, because I think that we all have a role as women everywhere we go. Part of educating the system, if you will, is speaking up about this. So before your husband dies, for goodness sake, if your financial advisor is not talking to you and is not addressing your concerns, bring it up. I mean, not in a militant and angry way, but I may very well fire my financial advising firm shortly. I like them, But I've had a conversation with them about my concerns and the fact that they have no female decision makers on their investing staff. And when I asked for one referral of an estate attorney who was female, they couldn't produce one. And to me, it's walk your talk. You know, so I'm educating them by very politely and respectfully bringing up these issues and saying, you have an opportunity to address them. I'm watching. But if they don't, I'll take my business somewhere else. And I think if we all start doing that,
that's
we'll start
advice.
To see some change.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So connecting soft skills.
Connecting soft skills.
You just like triggered me there for a
no,
moment.
No, that's good. We wanted a lively panel.
Yeah. So I think that the brain science perspective, at least in my clientele, because I work primarily in technology firms and secondarily in the entertainment industry, plays really well because it comes from a very logical, research-based perspective. Everybody wants to know the secret decoder ring to how your brain works and how human relationships work. And if you can spend some time there and show them some ahas about their general life before taking them into the content about bias, it kind of sucks people in. It's a natural bridge between soft skills and hard science. But beyond that, there are an awful lot of quote-unquote soft skills that companies that double down on these tend to have really great business results and good diversity numbers. And it's kind of a chicken and an egg sort of thing. Did the diversity produce the results, or did the culture produce the diversity? And I think it's a little bit of both. But these are skills like conversational turn-taking, rewarding inclusive behaviors, rewarding people who make clear requests and agreements, rewarding behavior that's more inquiry-based than advocacy-based. So instead of having a shout-down culture, having a culture that rewards people that invite others into the conversation and are synthesizers of conversations. Those are cultures where women do well. Those are cultures that produce good business results. And so I think sometimes when we don't look specifically at the diversity issue and we talk about what kind of culture will produce the best results for everybody, there's kind of the collateral benefit of also benefiting the diverse population.
So thank you. So now we're going to kind of move to this lead and advocacy piece. And Marian, you and I were having a conversation about a younger man that you ran into that really reframed this and your response and the response that you've gotten from others. Can you share that?
Sure. So I recently had a situation where I was speaking with a young man who is a millennial. And he approached me and he shared that he considers himself a feminist. And so, and he said, you know, he goes, I'm a feminist. And I was like, oh, well, how curious, you know, that's interesting. And he's like, well, I don't understand your reaction. That's what he said back to me. And so I was intrigued, right? Because you don't even hear a lot of women coming around saying that they're feminists, right? So for a young man to come and say that, I was really intrigued by that. So got a conversation going. And in this course of the conversation, what he shared with me is that he feels like this gender gap is going to close on its own with these millennials, because millennials, in his opinion, do not see that. They don't understand, like, what's the big deal? What's the big deal between men and women? Like, you guys are just as capable as we are. And so it gave me great hope for our future, because what I kept thinking is, wow, you know, this is someone who's going to be running an organization in 20, 30 years, hopefully, and really understands that. And so I see hope. You know, I feel like there's a hope here, and that there's a path where folks are really starting to try to see that there is that balance. And I think, you know, where it was really eye-opening for me was actually in the last election as well, because a lot of millennials, from what I understand, did not vote for Hillary because she was a woman. In other words, what I'm trying to say is they didn't use that as a factor to determine who they were voting for, right? And so I think that that's great because a lot of folks that are my age are going, well, no, I needed to vote for her because she's a woman, regardless of whatever else, right? It's a woman and we need a woman president. And in their eyes, it wasn't a factor. It wasn't an issue. And so I thought that was really interesting. And it also just gave me a lot of hope for our future and our organizations as we continue to progress.
Yeah, and in my mind, the value there is having the conversation. It kind of goes back to listen. Yeah. How do you start to have conversations? Yeah. And wouldn't it be interesting to just open a staff meeting and say, oh, let's talk about the word feminist in our company. Wow, you want to see jaws drop?
Yeah.
But what dawns on me is we have to demystify this stuff. Because I will tell you, men don't want to talk about this, and women don't want to talk about it. And what we lose is so much by not genuinely getting to know and appreciate each other's differences. And so I actually think the value is in the conversation, you know, doing some of that. And Mary, that actually leads to what you and I spoke about around this notion of mentoring, sponsorship, and actually seeking out mentors and who are vastly different than you and some of the successful male mentors that you've had.
Yeah.
So what's your point of view on that?
Well, so first of all, I think it's important to be purposeful as you're looking for a mentor and to allow it to happen naturally if possible. I know sometimes that can be a little more challenging. But over my career, I've purposely sought out mentors for various reasons throughout my career. For example, the first mentor I ever had, I started with another well-known investment firm in the late 90s, and I was one of just a couple of women in a pretty large region in North Carolina, and I sought out one of the other women that was more tenured to help me learn how to navigate it. I was young. I was 21 years old. I didn't know which way was up, and so trying to learn to navigate a very male-dominated world, both from the client perspective, because the men were coming to my office as clients, and as a peer perspective, was hugely valuable to get her perspective there. But from that point, many of my other mentors were purposely sought out to be male. And I did that on purpose, as I mentioned, for a reason. I wanted to get a different perspective. I wanted to learn to see the world through their eyes so that I could understand how I could better navigate and how I should, you know, potentially not change myself, but potentially view my conversations differently. Is there a different way that I could negotiate something? Is there a different way that I could approach something? Is there a different way that I should be asking for what I want, negotiating a salary, things like that, that I think men bring expertise in and experience in that I knew at the time I was definitely still learning. And so I purposely sought out male mentors to help me learn and grow in those spaces. I also seek out mentors that I feel like can have a reciprocal relationship. So I think that if you're looking for a mentor, seeking out somebody that you can add value to, as well as them adding value to you, so that it's not just a one-way street or one-way relationship. So I seek out mentors that maybe we have a business connection, and I know they have an interest in my business, and I can bring value to our one-to-one meetings, as well as them adding value to my space as well. But getting that differing opinion, I think women tend to look for other women to be their mentor. I know almost everybody, I want to say everybody, I can think of one male that has proactively reached out to me to be their mentor. Every one of them has been a female. And the one male was actually suggested to come and see me by a female. So you could even link that to a female. But I think, you know, we've got to reach out to men and not be afraid to do that as well. And then as I look at the people that I mentor, I've got to proactively reach out to men is what I learned when I realized that. So I think we've got to be okay with getting different opinions from people, whether they're of different races or backgrounds or lifestyles or gender. That makes a far more powerful mentor relationship.
And what's really powerful about what she said is she didn't pick up the phone or email somebody and say, would you mentor me?
Yeah.
It's a very mindfulness to say, I want your opinion.
Yes.
Can you give me your advice? Because research shows women are very hesitant to, you know, to reach out or raise their hand and say, I want you to mentor me. I don't think anybody's comfortable saying, you know, I want you to mentor me. But these techniques of, I'd appreciate your input. I'd love your point of view. Can you tell me about this?
What can I bring to you?
Right. Yeah,
so there might there's something that I can add value to you while I'm asking for your opinion on something else. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, asking for a mentor kind of sounds like an arranged marriage. It's kind of awkward. So, will you be my friend?
Exactly. Will you be my friend? That's funny. I'm going to take one more question to Janet, and then we're going to go to audience Q&A. And I know our time is short. So if you have questions, I would ask you to step up to one of the two microphones. We're going to get started here with Q&A as soon as I ask Janet this last question. So you work with a lot of male managers, and they're managing a younger workforce. One of the questions that always comes up is, okay, I'm at a lower level. I get it. What about those guys? And so how do you deal with this dynamic of, number one, coaching men, but then also for many of the people in our audience who aren't at that senior level, what advice do you have for you know, creating that dialogue upward?
So, first of all, one of the things that I have actually helped facilitate in organizations, and so this isn't necessarily the advice for the individual person here, but for those of you who are heads of programs, I've done a lot of work in the entertainment industry, and we've all heard about the entertainment industry recently, right? But what happens in many industries, tech included, is that there's this kind of, you know, I'm a young woman. I don't want to go to a senior male manager and ask that person to sponsor me or mentor me or even have a conversation with them. And so one way that organizations can help with that is to do some matchmaking out of an established program. So these young women know they're going to come back into a program and talk about their conversations with their mentor or sponsor. And that creates a kind of a safe place where there's not going to be the kind of harassment that might take place if those conversations took place outside of an official setting. But we also structure these things as two-way. So this is reverse mentoring as well. These senior executives don't know about the millennial generation. They don't necessarily know a lot about working with diverse populations. They may not know very much about working with women. And so part of your role is to bring your perspective on where the world is headed and where the marketplace is headed to the top executive. So there's a little bit of a balancing of power there. And I think one of the ways that that can happen, even if you're not part of one of these formal kind of programs, is to think about what do you have of value in terms of perspective on what's happening in your generation, what's happening in your community that connects to the business objectives and the strategy of the organization. And find ways, maybe it's not with the top level person, but somebody who is amenable to having the conversation. And there's tons of really great men out there who would love to have these conversations with you. So find one of those men and start that conversation of value with them. And then ask them, who else do I need to be connected with here? Who should I be sharing these stories with? How do I build my brand image within this organization so that I can move up? And I think that you'll find that there are an awful lot of people willing to help out if you approach it from that perspective.
And one of those key points is just something as simple as calling them and saying, hey, do you have 5 minutes? And I want to talk to you about your career and decisions you made. Because what I will tell you is every senior leader I've ever met, male or female, wants to talk about their career and their successes. And that 5 minutes is going to turn into an hour. And then they're going to go, oh, my God, that Janet was so smart to seek me out. And so there's a transference of credibility. Yeah. So everyone has 5 minutes for you. Everyone has 5 minutes for you. So thank you all for sharing that. So we've got questions. So we'll start over here, and then we're going to go there and go back to you. And give your name and your company, please.
My name is Leanne Penn, and I work for a local bank here in Austin, Horizon Bank. And working for a bank, a lot of our senior leadership is represents you, I would say, like older white males, and they are getting ready to, some of them are getting ready to move into retirement. So my question to you is, how do I, as an HR professional, also as a young millennial woman in the workforce, how do I foster these gender partnerships within my organization so that when these senior leadership positions are vacated, that we do see more of an equal balance of 50-50, so that when we're making organization decisions that we are accurately representing the population that we serve?
Yeah, so I think some of the techniques that I talked about earlier, I think And I don't know if this is something that your senior executive team would be open to fostering, because I think there's power when there's senior leadership support, for sure. That being said, I do think that it can be done from a grounds up and a grassroots perspective as well. But fostering some of the speed networking events that we've hosted have been really successful. So we ask for volunteers, and by asking for volunteers, I mean proactively go out and say, John, will you participate in this speed networking event or the speed mentoring event? Sarah, will you participate? And we gather executives to come and participate in those. And it's kind of like speed dating. So the individuals that sign up for it go around the table and they get like 5 minutes with each executive. And it's very powerful to get advice in a really short snippet format from a variety of perspectives. And that begins to introduce both sides. So you have the executives that are getting to know the individuals that are participating. And then you've also got the individuals that are participating that are hearing advice and guidance from senior executives. I think tips like or techniques like that that just begin to break down the walls between not only executives and individual contributors or entry-level managers, but also begin to foster that conversation across the genders is important.
And I'll give you one more because you're in HR, but too deep succession planning, and what does it look like? Something is simple. We did this at Coca-Cola, and it was so eye-opening to our senior leadership team. We took the top 100 leaders in the company and put their picture up. And then we put the picture up of the next two logical people who would replace them. And we brought leadership in. And what do you think was looking back at them? It was about 280 men. Hmm. And just this visual shock of, oh my gosh, what are we doing? Can just speak volumes. And you're an HR professional. You need to be scaring them to death about succession planning. So, I'm a big fear person. I find it works with men. So thanks. We're going to go over
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Melanie Merrick, and I'm a current PhD student at the University of Texas. I'm in the chemical engineering department, which is about 40% women, so better than some other.
Good. Yeah.
That's really close great. To 50. Yeah. That's good.
Great.
I'm very active in some of the student organizations that promote graduate student women support networks, such as the Society of Women Engineers, and our department has one as well. But what I've noticed is some members of my research group, male and female, kind of don't buy into that. We do invite men to our events as well, and we have a handful that show up, just to note. But for example, these members of my research group say, men and women are equal. Why do women need specific scholarships? Why do they need specific student organizations? So I'm curious if you have some advice about how I can start that conversation with them and, reach out and help them understand why advocacy is so important.
You know what I would say, just to start the conversation, the fact is that even though it kind of goes back to the millennial conversation I was having earlier, right, about how they just don't see the difference or the bias. But if you look at just the cold, hard facts and the statistics of what the workforce looks like, you can't deny that there's obviously a disparity there, right? So I think that, just opening their eyes by starting there and making sure that they understand that there is a disparity and there is a need for us to be able to have avenues to promote and foster women in a field that's not traditionally women run, right? And so I think that once they start to understand that, and I also would point to what Jeffrey said at the beginning, everyone has a sister, mother, a daughter, and it's hard. I think that when you personalize things, right, when it's like, if you had a sister that was in this role, wouldn't you want somebody to be there to step up and support them? I think that helps a lot too, Jeffrey.
Yeah. I also, I'll just add to it, I think real world examples, I'm married to a millennial who didn't think there was a gender issue at all until I got into a different role at my job, and all of a sudden I'd come home with stories and he's like, wow, I had no idea. And so we've started to discuss it more and more in our own home, and there are just little nuances that he now picks up on that he never saw before, All women, or I'm sorry, a mixed group of soldiers who were being acknowledged on the football field like a couple months ago, and they called them all servicemen. And he's like, why didn't they say and women? They didn't say and women. It's little things that he now notices, but we got there by talking about real world stories, talking about, you know, other people who have had experiences in other fields, military or otherwise, and have felt discrimination. But I would suggest seek out real world examples, because I think people think, well, that doesn't happen anymore. Like, that was way back when. That doesn't happen now, but it still does.
Yeah, and I would add to this a couple of things. I am both heartened and disheartened by the millennial generation, because I think that this idea that gender and race and all of these other considerations have gone away with this generation is simply untrue. And coming from the San Francisco Bay Area and having worked for a venture capital firm, I can tell you that the people that are getting investments at 97% are the millennial men, not women. And they don't even know how to get into the system, let alone get an investment. So there is a huge disparity still. But that being said, I could spend an hour on this topic, but one little nugget that I will give you is that the brain works differently when you are in a cohort of your own versus when you are the odd person out. It is an incredible stressor on the brain to be the only representative or one of a few representatives of your group in a system that was designed for the preferences of the other group. So it is not equal. Yes, I agree. Men and women are equal. Black and white are equal. We are biologically equal in our ability to perform in the workplace. But the workplace itself and the system that we exist within is far from equal. And so we do need to have these opportunities to equalize the power dynamic for women. And we're going to have those for a long time, and not just women, but for a lot of other members of our society.
Thank you. Over here.
Hi, my name is Liana Nicholas. I work for ARM. We're a semiconductor company here in town, and we're about 17% women. We recently started a women's network, which has been a really great thing for the women at our company, but our company is also full of a lot of really great men. I've gotten questions from men at the company, and some of the women too, what we can do for men to kind of help them get involved in diversity conversation. I guess what I'm looking for is event ideas. What kinds of speakers could we have? What kinds of trainings or sessions? What kinds of fun events do you think would be good to kind of help bridge that gap and make men feel like they are invited in?
And I think you know, a bunch of the panelists have touched on some of the things they've got going on: mentoring, sponsoring, speed mentoring, dating, whatever that is. Just bringing in panels are very cheap. And one more we were talking about on the way over here, doing a day in the life of or a lunch with leader. And this is something we did at Coke, where we had a senior woman basically do a brown bag lunch with 25, 35 women, and I would obviously include men in that now. What we found out is after a year, we ran out of women, and so we started inviting men in to the women's resource group, and all of a sudden they were like, what are they going to ask me? And you could see them really concerned, and it's like, well, they want to ask you about your career, and yeah, they may want to know who takes care of your family, and you know, and it's creating those dialogues. But what we found out was, after we invited three or four men in, men were raising their hand because if I thought Dave's getting this thing, well, I could, you know, I could support that. So anything to get people together and talking will go a long way to really fostering that.
So this isn't an event per se. You may have seen some cards on your chairs. I co-wrote an article called How to Be a Good Guy, and that's not a snarky title, by the way. That came directly from men who had engaged in these conversations, and they were the good men that you're talking about who really want to be supportive of equity, but they're not really sure what that means and what it looks like. And they would say to me, I really want to be one of the good guys. How do I do that? And so I wrote this article, How to Be a Good Guy, and you can get a download of it on that card if you pick one up on the chair.
Great. Yeah. Over here.
Or give it to somebody else that needs it.
And I'm speeding things up because I'm getting the thing, but we want to get through these last three questions. So.
Say it quick. Hi, I'm Molly Prim. I work for Summit Hotel Properties. My office is not very diverse. It's probably about 20% women. There are zero women in the executive side of the office, excluding myself. And I'm not an executive myself, just getting into the industry. But my question for y'all is, I'm very much excluded as far as lunches, as far as traditional meetings, and how do I, on a day-to-day basis, break down those barriers? I have a great mentorship. The CEO himself is actually my mentor, and I'm very much supported by him, but how do I break down those barriers with the other gentlemen in our office?
So one of the things that I would ask you is what you have done also to try and break down those, because I think that, you know, in my experience, it just takes one person that you have a relationship with that can open a lot of other doors for you. And so, you know, what I've tried to do on my end is really try to focus on that one relationship that can then that I can expand from there. So that I would point to that as a starting point. And it sounds like you've got a good relationship with your CEO, which could be a great way to open doors for you. But also, have you had that honest conversation, you know, around, can we go to lunch? I'd like to be part of that. I'd like to be at the table.
Sometimes it's unintentional.
Yeah.
It could be intentional.
It's unintentional.
So just bringing it to their attention could solve very easily that challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mickey Ristroff with Mutual Mobile. I want to go back to this sort of quintessential millennial sort of living with this blindness. My question is, just very practically, when is that helpful and when is it stupid? When should we kind of embrace that blindness and say, yeah, you know, just kind of choose to see the world that way? And when is that behavior actually harmful?
Sounds like
go ahead,
I actually.
I think that's a Janet question.
I'm looking to research question.
I'm looking that way too.
The quick answer is that for an individual, it's oftentimes more useful to view the world through rose-colored glasses. It's oftentimes useful to not see the bias, because when you see the bias too much, it can start to be overwhelming and can start to represent a huge threat at a neural level. So when we put our attention on that as an individual, that's very difficult. The problem is that if all the collective individuals ignore that it's there just so that they can get through the day, we never change anything. Mm-hmm. So I think what we need to do is to be selective about when we decide to just say, you know what, I'm going to ignore that this is out there. I'm just going to forge ahead as though everything were copacetic. But I'm also going to form networks and groups that have a power structure to them. So when we come to this conference and you all applaud when I say fire your financial advisor if you're seeing bias, that's collective power, and we really need to exercise that. Mm-hmm. But in those individual situations, it can be advantageous not to pay attention. I don't know if that answered your question. But
it does. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And over here, our last question.
All right, so my name is Kara Gresslin. I work for David Weekly Homes, so construction industry. You can probably imagine what that looks like. And my question is, we have a fair amount of male leadership that says, you know, we are open to and we want to encourage, you know, the women in our, you know, in our industry and in our company specifically to move up. However, when we approach them about these potential leadership roles, they are not interested. And and I think it's because they think, okay, well, the woman would have to act exactly like the man, that she is succeeding. And truthfully, a lot of that doesn't look attractive for those of us that may be filling those roles. So how do we have that conversation and potentially change their perception of what filling those leadership roles looks like with women, because we are different. Our priorities are different. The demands on our time are different, especially in our 30s and 40s. And so it's, you know, it seems they say this, but then, you know, when it comes to it, they go, but the women don't want that. And we're like, well, yeah, we don't want it. That doesn't look attractive at all. So, or only halfway.
Well, I'll speak. I think I know, because your question had a lot of pieces
I know,
to
I'm
it.
Sorry.
That's okay. But I can speak to a part of it. So I know in the financial services industry, we've had some of this challenge where we've had women who get into leadership roles, and then they're held to an expectation that their male counterparts have been able to work. So, for example, I'm going to be in the office from 8 to 6 every day. And this does not does not mean what you're going to achieve. It's about the hours that you are in the office. And the woman might say, okay, I can be in the office from 8:30 to 5:30, but I've got to drop kids off and pick kids up, and I've got other balances, but I'll log on and I'll work later, or I'll work early in the morning and then take the kids in. And it's just about more flexibility. And what we did is when we had a couple of women leave leadership roles, we interviewed them and we asked, what happened? Why did you leave? Because they stayed within the broader enterprise, but they left our organization. And they told us it was flexibility. They're like, you're expecting me to fit into a mold, and I've got a different life than the other individuals that are around me. And I want flexibility to work around that. So we have been really focused on adding some of that flexibility. It's a challenging muscle to change because you're talking about a lengthy history of operating. But I think asking women what they need from the role and bringing that to the attention, and you talked a little bit about this last night, asking women what they need in order to be able to do that job effectively, and then making those changes so that we can support them in that role is going to be a part of that, absolutely.
And it's connecting it back to the business case as well, because that's how work used to get done.
Right.
It's not how we're going to work in the future. And, oh, by the way, they're going to have trouble getting millennials who want to work like that.
Yeah.
They're going to have trouble with the new workforce mm-hmm. that wants to work like that. And so, that's Mary and I were talking last night. And basically, I tell senior leaders, there's only one thing you have to do to retain talent, and that is ask them what they want and give it to them. And it's that easy. And it goes against every program and policy and work process and structure that you have in your organization. But you're going to lose talent. And so until you stop this, the way work is done, and oh, by the way, I know where you are 24/7, you're yeah. attached at the hip. So,
and all
so
you need is one in that role.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, so I set a shadow of leadership within my organization. I come in at 8:30 and I'm usually gone by 5:30 or 6, and I log on at work at night, or I log on in the morning and work, but I've got little kids at home, and I can't work 12 straight hours in the office like I could, you know, 8 or 9 years ago before they were born. And so setting that example, if you can get one person in the role to begin to set a different example that it can be done and you can still be effective, that has huge ripple impacts.
And I think that the other question that was embedded in what you were talking about is that not all women want to do leadership in the way men have traditionally done leadership. And one of the bridges there is that there's quite a bit of research out there about what makes an effective leader. And many of the traits that we have deemed as being feminine traits are the kinds of traits that predispose business results. So collaborative behaviors, nurturing behaviors, there's a whole long list of them. But if as an organization you can start to identify what does the leadership of the future, what should they look like? What kinds of attributes would give us the best business results? And then what does that look like in practice? Mm-hmm. Before you even have the gender conversation. And then say, okay, who in our pipeline has that kind of predisposition and is headed toward those behaviors? You've done a bit of an end round around the gender conversation, and you've also helped women who are more interested in leading that way up the pipeline. Mm-hmm.
So we have to wrap up, and I know we have one more question. We're going to hang around. If you want to ask that, just because I know we got people who've got to go.
Understand. And my name's Calista Aguilar, and I work for Shell Oil. And I just wanted to bring up this topic because I haven't heard it, because obviously the gender issues have revolved around the U.S. But globally, how do you deal with disparity issues with the European men or the, you know, et cetera, just other cultures? And you could maybe speak to that, and maybe there, you know, there isn't... maybe there's not differences that have already been addressed, but I just wanted to kind of hear your input there.
Strong points of view?
We don't have a heavy international presence, so that would be challenging for me to answer, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would, we did a lot of work with that at Coca-Cola, and the point is, you know, women can kind of be the global entry point to diversity and inclusion conversations, but culture, ethnicity, socioeconomic, religion are all various dimensions. And it really boils down to, at the end of the day, what kind of organization do you want? What kind of employee skill set do you need and demand? What's fascinating is a lot of the business case I talked about, most of Northwestern Europe, Canada are actually in more dire trouble from a talent standpoint. Germany, France, they have no workers. They're well ahead of the problem. And then you get into Latin America where you've got other, you know, elements of culture. So it's starting with women, but it's the principles are the same. How do you talk about them? One of the things Coca-Cola did that a lot of multinationals do is almost an employee bill of rights, which says when you're in these four walls, you may be LGBT in Saudi Arabia. Within these four walls, this is the way you will be treated, and it is with dignity and respect. I can't protect you in the culture, but if you're drawing a paycheck from a company, I can certainly hold you to standards of performance. And that's up to the company to take that stand. But then you get into all those different layers. So with that said, so please thank our panelists for their time. We're going to hang around for a few.